join us, and we hope you'll stay with us for the next, 25 minutes or so, as they are back, Matt and Chris, they're back into the K-Dove studios here. They found us in our new location. They were the troupe that closed out the old address. It was right after these guys got off the air that we start pulling plugs and wires and get
that
the saws and hammers
much,
out.
Doesn't it, Chris?
I thought it was a little rude that you didn't actually tell us where you moved to. And we had to find it for ourselves. I get the impression you didn't want us back or something, Pat.
We did the best we can.
Bloodhound really did us in. But anyway, no, of course that's not the case.
I noticed Sue had kind of a grimace on her face when we walked through the door. She probably
found us. Hi, fellas.
Yeah, good to see you again.
Well, we're going to do it anyway, and here it is. Going to be talking about a guy that goes way back. You know, I mean, Christian history, obviously, 2,000 years old, and in those 2,000 years, you know, you're going to have some earlier guys, late guys. This is one of the earlier guys.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about today, Pat, Constantine the Great. Actually, he didn't call himself Constantine the Great, although he probably thought himself the Great at the time he was alive. And we're talking roughly in the third century and early fourth century,
which equals 200, late 200s,
yeah.
Early 300s.
Yeah, exactly. That was the years of his life. You know, lots of people, if you know anything about Constantine, lots of people have different viewpoints on his life. Some people considered him a ruthless political opportunist. Other people thought he was the worst thing that ever happened to the Christian church, and yet in the Eastern church especially, they consider him a saint and a wonderful man. And in reality, as a Roman emperor, Constantine was all these things and probably a whole lot more.
Wow.
And what we remember Constantine for, and why he is typically remembered in church history, is for really a revolution that he started in 313 AD with what was known as the Edict of Toleration. And what this set in motion was the ending of persecution of Christians in the Roman Empire and the gradual making of Christianity the religion of state. However, there's a whole lot more to the story, obviously, and one of the famous stories is about the cross and the vision that he saw in the sky, and also what was behind the background of Constantine ending persecution of the church. What was that story? Matt, why don't you share a little bit about that?
Okay, well, just to paint the picture, this is, gosh, you know, 300 years, 400 years of the Roman Empire, and it's just gotten so big and so corrupt and so widespread, it's just collapsing. It's fallen apart. And one of the last emperors, one of the ones that he was a really good governor, I mean, he really strengthened the collapsing Roman Empire, but persecuted a lot of Christians, was Diocletian. Mm. And one last gambit that he used was to divide this widespread struggling empire into four parts and appoint four, basically, Caesars. He called it the Tetrarchy, but it didn't really work, but what it did set up was the stage for Constantine to take over. So here's the thing. Constantine, his dad's a Roman officer who's rapidly being promoted and actually gets promoted to be one of the minor Caesars in Britain. And so Constantine is sent to Emperor Diocletian to be apprenticed, read hostage, in Diocletian's palace. Well, and he does that for 10 years, and he's watching the persecutions, he's watching the tortures, the corruption, and he's getting really an education in statecraft, in Roman and Byzantine statecraft, which is not a pleasant thing.
Mm-hmm.
So after 10 years, his father is finally elevated to become the chief Caesar in the West,
wow,
as opposed to Diocletian in the East. And at this point, we're not sure if he escapes or what, but somehow he gets out from under Diocletian.
And they head out to actually go out to the province of Britannia, what we call today England, to deal with some of your relatives, Pat, the Picts. And
they were a gnarly bunch.
They had a Pict uprising. And they had to go out there and deal with them for a number of years.
And he established a reputation as a gnarly soldier.
Yeah, Constantine
fighting
was,
with his father.
He was quite the soldier, quite the agile leader, and was well liked. And
his troops called him Bullneck.
And he was a scrapper. You know, he knew how to fight and knew how to win, and was a real leader of men. And it was out on that battlefield that in Britannia that he learns of his father's demise, and immediately he is it's a scene out of Gladiator. It's a scene out of Braveheart. You know, you've got the legions that are applauding and acclaiming him, and they say, hey, we'll go with you anywhere, you're our emperor, we proclaim you emperor. And that's a nice thing to have, you know,
you're 25, you know.
And a legion of 40,000 men behind you saying, we'll back you up, you know, just go ahead and take office. And so here's Constantine now, young man. He wraps up things in Britannia, goes back to the continent, and sets up his headquarters. His dad's basic territories were what we know today as France, England, and Spain. I want to say Gaul, but Gaul is France, and I'm getting all confused here. He sets things up there, and one of the things that is most notable about Constantine as he takes up this new role is that he begins actually stopping the persecution of Christians in his provinces. And he actually goes so far as to make restitution to churches for wrongs that were done.
Wow.
So this is something that he does long before he really climbs up and ascends in power.
So this is a sensitive guy. I mean, he's a gnarly warrior, but he's also very attuned to human suffering. A lot of empathy, a lot of compassion. A very interesting young man. And as he's moving towards Italy now, thinking, you know, because one of the other little Caesars that is abusing things. What, Maxine?
What did they call those guys Caesar?
Moving right along. Well, this is a guy, Maxentius, who is in Rome itself, and he's another one of the assistant Caesars, and he's got the Senate's approval, but his support among the population is kind of shaky. And so it's an interesting story. We don't really have time to go into it a lot, but instead of just sitting where he's strong in Rome and taking this small army that's coming at him, he kind of gets cocky and decides to take his huge army out and meet Constantine, who's like 10 miles from the city at this point.
And when we say huge, we mean that his army outnumbers Constantine's 4-1.
Yeah, he's got like 160,000 guys.
It's crazy, the difference in troop strength.
So it was Constantine's intention then to go and establish control?
You know, you had many ways of ascending the throne in Rome, and sometimes it was by orderly succession. But a lot of times, as a matter of fact, throughout the vast amount of the history, you had to duke it out, basically, to get that seat.
As a matter of fact, if he had just sat in Britain, he would be dead rather quickly, because one of the other three guys would come after. That's just the way things were done. So it's do or die, you know, it's him or me. And Constantine says, okay, I'll go and grapple.
So he's on
his
way
into Rome.
He's on his way and marching towards Rome, and he stops to consider his battle plan and what he's going to do there. He knows that he's outnumbered by an incredible margin, and he says, you know, I need some divine help here. And we don't know all the details about what he believed or we didn't believe. We know his father was a monotheist, and the best we can tell is that he very much was aware of Christians and that he cried out to the God of the Christians, asking, you know, I need some help. And by the accounts we have from various people, not just one person, but various people of the time, in the middle of the day, he and many of his troops saw a vision in the sky of a cross and heard the words, in this sign you shall conquer. And Constantine also talks about the night before that Jesus appears to him in a dream and once again reinforces this. And whatever else happened, because there's been several variations on the account, we know that Constantine saw something. We know it had to do with the cross, that he had confidence he was going to win. But the one thing that he was to do was he went out and he put the cross on the standards of his army as they go out to meet the army of Maxentius. And it's quite a great thing. They get up, they march towards Rome. Maxentius comes out, and they have the battle on the famous Milvian Bridge. And it's the great. It's something that we would expect to see in a good war movie or something.
Yeah, we need a movie.
The leader, Maxentius, you know, he comes out to fight, and he's all covered in his armor and everything, and he sees the battles going against him, and for an escape, and he gets knocked off the bridge, and he falls into the river, and the weight of his armor, he drowns.
Glug,
he just goes right down to the bottom. One of those great stories, you know, that full of intrigue and everything, and Constantine comes to power. He is now undisputed in the West and goes ahead. And from that point forward, we know that he gave glory to God for that and really pursued the remainder of his life Christianity and helping the Christian church.
But he wasn't done consolidating his political power yet. This took care of the West, but in the East, one of the Caesars had died, so the main Caesar in the East is now a guy called Licinius. And he and Constantine get together after this, and they know they're either going to kill each other or they're going to have a peace treaty. And so they get together.
They ended up killing each other.
Well, they did, but that took 10 years. But for right now, they're just going to get along together, and Constantine gives his sister to be married to Licinius. And, you know, Licinius agrees to the Treaty of Toleration, which is the one that says, okay, from now on, it's a level playing field. No religion will be persecuted. The Christians are safe. The pagans are safe. The Zoroastrians are safe. Everybody can practice their own form of worship without being persecuted by the empire.
Even the Jews?
Which was a big deal. Yeah, well, the Jews, bless their hearts, they got beat up from time to time anyway. It's the way things were and always have been, right. But they officially were accorded the same good treatment. Rome actually treated the Jews pretty well as a policy, you know, when they weren't laying waste to Jerusalem and things like that.
Yeah.
But they gave them more liberties than they did almost anybody else.
I remember that.
It's very interesting. So now we have a 10-year period where Constantine is consolidating his power in Italy. Licinius is tolerating the Christians, but he doesn't like them. He might even have dabbled with the idea of being a Christian one time. But basically, two rival Caesars, one east, one west. And Constantine is the stronger, and he continues to grow in strength. And finally, Licinius tries to do battle with him and is defeated two and three times, is finally captured. Finally, in 324, is captured the final time and is executed. And this is not a great loss to the world. Licinius was kind of a slime. But now, 324, Constantine is the consolidated sole emperor of the new Roman Empire. And several things happen from that point.
There's a big change. One of the biggest changes, one of the really world-shaking changes he did, was he moved the capital of Rome to a little town in the corner, it would be in the northwest corner of Turkey, what we know today as Istanbul. There was a little town there called Byzantium, and he saw that as a very strategic place because it would be the center, really the center of all of the area that he would rule over. And Constantine basically completely revamps and builds a magnificent city there, a city that was renowned all over the world. He builds the biggest churches in the world there. He builds impregnable fortifications, fortified walls there, and civic monuments that were the envy of the entire world. And basically, he creates this entire city that Rome ever was, as far as, you know, the glory and the magnitude of it. And then, of course, in the ever-so-modest way, he names it after himself and calls it Constantinople. And this becomes really ground zero, the new ground zero, the capital of the world.
Now, and just for fun, this building and rejuvenation of art and everything extends to much farther than just Constantinople.
Oh, yes.
He sent his mom out to the Holy Land to find where was Christ born, where was he crucified, all the holy sites. And she did, and they built huge churches on him, the Church
of
the Nativity.
Was the mom a Christian?
Oh, yeah.
Helena. She would have to be, yeah.
We're going to talk about her next month,
okay.
Christian mothers.
Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
So anyway, this move, though,
interrupting
I know, with
you?
These
God,
questions
honestly.
Of his, I don't know what to think of this. Anyway, you know, the move to Constantinople actually had two great effects that actually changed the world. First of all, it was really the inauguration of a new empire. If you would have asked them at the time, they would have said, no, this is not a new empire. This is a continuation of the Roman Empire. But in fact, it really was a new empire because it had a new heart to it. It had a heart of Christianity to it. And it also had kind of a new idea emerging out of it called the rule of law. And these two things really gave a different complexion to this empire that was really started by Constantine, and it was known as the Byzantine Empire. And what a lot of people don't know, well, a lot of people don't even know about it, what a lot of people don't realize is that it only ended 551 years ago, actually, and that it outlasted the Roman Empire. It was
1,100 years.
It was the longest empire of its sort in human history. And so it had that effect. The other effect was, though, is the abandoning of Rome and moving everything, the seat of civil and spiritual power, to Constantinople. Rome had a vacuum. And what, in essence, happened there was the Pope became, the Bishop of Rome, became the de facto temporal ruler as well as the spiritual ruler of the West, which emerged out of that, of course, the institution we know today as the papacy. And so Constantine didn't have that in mind when he did that, but there's always consequences to the decisions.
Sure.
And that was one of the consequences, accidents of history that happened, and the Pope emerged, and of course we have a whole different relationship, his relationship to Europe.
He sort of cleared the floor for the building of Western civilization.
Exactly. You'd almost think that.
Golly. Well, you know, it's not all that he did, because, that was the building, the temporal stuff, but turning to his spiritual walk is very interesting. I guess we've talked about, you know, was he really a Christian? Was he not? And we believe that he was, towards the end at least. One of the things that he was most concerned with was unity in the church. And he was an indifferent theologian. I mean, he just wasn't, you know, a real cerebral, brilliant guy. He was a fighter and a politician.
He was thick-necked.
Yeah, he was bull-necked, that's
bull-necked,
right.
Whatever.
And but, you know, he had a pretty good heart. But what he wanted, after persecution had ceased, basically, the church realized, oh my gosh, you know, we've got about 20 different ideas for who Christ is and what the nature of God. We really need to get on page here. You know, what do we really believe as the body of Christ? And so he called together hundreds of bishops from all over the kingdom together at Nicaea, right near Constantinople.
Which is where his palace was,
mm-hmm.
His summer palace. And we have, of course, the Council of Nicaea was the first universal council of the church, where the unified doctrine of the Orthodox, all the Orthodox creeds that we continue to believe today that form a basis of unity in the church, that was really at the instigation of Constantine himself. He was shocked. Of course, we shouldn't be shocked when you think about years of persecution. Who had time to be worrying about theology?
Yeah.
Now that there was the unity that was possible through government support, Constantine was able to be a catalyst in that. And like I said, though, or like what Matt said, he was not a theologian, but he was definitely an instigator and a catalyst for something that was bigger than probably he had any idea.
Well, we look at it today, and you know, the whole question of Arianism, was Jesus fully divine as well as fully human? That's huge for us. I mean, that's the dividing line between who we as the body of Christ consider who is Christian and who is not. You know, whether you're Orthodox or Catholic or Protestant, it doesn't matter. You use the Nicene Creed as kind of the watershed, the standard of measure. And golly, Constantine wasn't even that concerned with it. He didn't even think that it was that important an issue. As a matter of fact, his closest advisor continued to be an Arian bishop, even though sometimes for political expediency he had to banish the guy. and then 10 years later he would banish the other guy. It was very interesting. He was a very practical guy, but he did desire unity. He knew that, you know, guys, one unifying Orthodox creed, and that's what everybody needs to get behind.
So this was the moral authority behind the new legislation of this. And he didn't count it to see himself as inaugurating an empire. He was just kind of moving the capital from the west to the center.
I think he saw himself
as a change,
but more of a reinvigorating of the old glories of Rome. It was just much more practical to move it to the center of the empire, since he was now ruling east and west. And if you look on a map, that is absolutely the most practical center spot for anybody to move a capital city. And it strategically I mean, that's why it held for so long, was it? It was pretty impregnable, where it was very defensible, I should say. So
having said this, you know, we're now down to the nubbin of the issue is, you know, why is Constantine important, and what is the evidence to suggest that this was a Christian ruler? And right off the bat, I want to say, golly, he utilized all of the standard political tools at his disposal. He utilized assassination. He utilized, I don't know if it, frank betrayal, but...
Good old-fashioned palace intrigue.
Yeah, he was on board with all of these things. You know,
this is 400 years of history of Roman Empire-ness or Caesar-ness.
Exactly. You know, Matthew and I were discussing this, that really, if you had that kind of behavior in your minister or your priest, that would be reprehensible. But, you know, Constantine didn't make claim to be a clergyman. He was an emperor.
He's a politician.
And he was a politician. And so for us to, you know, to foist that on him is kind of an unfair thing. He was a man that had incredible power, and he was kind of the first of his kind. And so he was plowing new ground.
He really was. I mean, imagine being a Christian, the first Christian with big political power.
King of the entire world.
Yeah, I mean, what do you do with that? You know, there's no precedent. There's no rules. You know, Augustine has not laid out division of church and state. Nobody's made comments on this. There's no commentaries. There's no philosophies to deal with it. You are the guy. You are the first guy. You have been trained for the first 30 years of your life in warfare, corruption, politics, assassination, and you just happen to come to the Lord. Well, what do? You just come make it up as you go along. You just do the best you can. And looking at the fruit of his life, I mean, this is a guy who took care of widows and orphans, made reparations to Christians who had been stolen from or had their property confiscated.
He financed church buildings. He financed the copying of the scriptures, the production of scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
Gladiator games were suppressed. Women's rights were increased.
Slavery
became abolished. He set in motion the abolition of slavery in the Roman Empire. There was just a lot of things that
wow,
so much related to his faith. Of course, we talked about the church council. Also, he made Sunday, which was the traditional day of Christian worship. A lot of people think that Constantine was the one that made Sunday, made it up as the day of worship, you know, as kind of an anti-Sabbath thing or whatever. But actually, in reality, that's not true. He took something that was already practiced by Christians, and he codified that, and he made it an empire-wide day of observance, as in the Lord's Day on Sunday.
And he was known for being practical, you know, in terms of determining the date of Easter, getting Christmas going, a bunch of these things that he was very willing to use what the pagans had already set up and stamp it and modify it and mold it in a Christian shape.
But lest you think that all was sweetness and light with Constantine, you know, there was definitely some things that this uneasy marriage between power and religion caused that probably were not the best things for the church.
You mean that he killed his wife and child?
Even aside from that issue, you know, the whole idea of as Christianity became a state religion, there were a lot of people who were added to the church not by conversion, but were added because it was seen as a means of acquiring power and moving ahead. And this, of course, if we can hearken back to shows we've done before, the whole idea of the desert fathers, people dropping out of society and going to pursue God in the desert, that was sort of a fallout from what
backlash
people,
kind of
a
thing.
Backlash kind of thing that
against
people were
faith.
Doing that. And then, of course, the corrosive influence of wealth. There was a lot of wealth given to the church by Constantine, and that always has a corrosive effect on spirituality. And even the fact that people began seeing the church as a place where you could gain temporal power, not spiritual power. Very interesting thing. And also, Constantine is known for having introduced, because of this marriage between the glory of the state and the glory of the Lord, there was a lot of introduction of elaborate vestments and liturgies and ceremonies and church positions in the church that just levels and layers and layers and layers of positions in the church that looked a lot like a government. And things that were not prohibited by our Lord, but were definitely not part of his ministry style.
You could earn a couple hundred of PhDs figuring out all the things he did wrong.
Yeah, so all was not sweetness and light, but given the times and the things he had to work with, it is an incredible story, and it definitely has had an impact not only on the church, but on Western civilization.
Well, it's amazing to consider the history of the church up before Constantine. It really is kind of a dividing point because you had scattering of the church and the fall of Jerusalem and the Pauls, the missionaries and the persecutions largely is what we remember for a couple hundred years before Constantine. And he ended all that and then didn't make Christianity the official religion.
He set things in motion.
Yeah.
You know, Pat, I want to just say in closing, I heard a lecture recently on Constantine, not from a Christian, but a secular historian. And just to give you an idea of the respect and the awe that the people had for Constantine, when he died in late May, and they could not immediately find the heir apparent to the throne for several months. And he was so respected that when they put him in his sarcophagus and he lay in state, for the rest of that summer, they still came in and brought state business before him because they were in such awe of him and his office that they couldn't bring it to anybody else. I think that makes a statement about the kind of person that Constantine was.
Well, there you go. That's a great story, and it's all true, of course, Constantine. And Chris White and Matt McAuliffe here to talk about that great individual. And I just always enjoy these conversations so much. I look forward to another one. I did ask about, somewhere it was in the back of my mind that Constantine's mom was
Helena, yeah.
And so you're going to do another program
on... We'll talk about her next month.
She'll come up with several other people in our topic next month.
Christian right. moms.
Christian moms.
It's Mother's Day
God
next month.
God bless them.
Where would we be?
No kidding.
Yeah, I think everybody should have a mother, Pat.
It's important.
So, we don't even have to vote on that one, Chris. Okay, well, thank you. It's, again, Matt McAuliffe and Chris White here. And we have more music ahead on the Daily Connection. We've got How to Manage Your Money as well. Stay with us.